military wing? The one you guys got caught whacking in Dubai? Co-founder, Mordecai asserted. Whatever, Harvath replied. Get in the van. Once the Israeli was inside, he climbed in behind him and shut the door. Mordecai took one of the seats in front of the racks of electronic equipment. Argos and Draco didn't care for him. Each of the enormous white dogs began to growl the moment he stepped inside. Nicholas ordered them to be quiet, but they refused to obey, and the growling continued. Harvath had never seen that before. Nicholas repeated the command, and the dogs finally fell silent.
With or without assistance, the little man clarified, Emirati intelligence would have figured out what happened.
So, you admit it came from you, Mordecai seethed.
I had nothing to do with it. But considering what an embarrassment it was for the Mossad, I can understand your professional desire for a scapegoat.
Mordecai looked at Harvath while pointing his finger at Nicholas.
He is a global criminal, wanted by more countries than I can count. America should not be giving this man safe haven.
They gave me more than safe haven. I even received a presidential pardon.
The Israeli couldn't even look at him. He continued to address his remarks to Harvath.
How could your country even consider bestowing the protections of its sovereignty on someone who blatantly traffics in stolen intelligence?
I don't know, Nicholas continued. Why don't we ask the American intelligence analyst serving life in prison 150 miles south of here for selling classified information to Israel? Remember him? He's the guy your government has made an official Israeli citizen. If only I could remember his name.
Jonathan Pollard, Harvath replied.
That's right. Pollard.
Completely different, Mordecai snapped, turning to face Nicholas.
The dog started growling again. Harvath had had enough.
Listen, you two can meet at the bike rack after study hall. Right now, I want what's on that memory card.
Nicholas began to say something, but Harvath silenced him. The dog seemed to sense his mood and fell quiet. Harvath handed the card to him.
How long is this going to take?
The little man responded, but did so while looking at Mordecai.
Piece of cake. This won't take long at all.
The pissing match notwithstanding, the reason Harvath had brought Nicholas and his rolling talk to the exchange was so that he could immediately go to work on the memory card. Out of professional courtesy, Harvath had invited Mordecai into the van. He didn't have an axe to grind with him. He wanted him there when Nicholas examined the card. It was both a sign of respect and the right thing to do. As Nicholas inserted the card into his tough book, Harvath reached into the cooler, withdrew a bottle of water, and offered it to Mordecai.
You doing okay? He asked.
The Israeli slowly curled and uncurled his hands. It was obvious he was in a tremendous amount of pain. Harvath pulled the bottle back, twisted the cap off, and then offered it to him again.
Thank you, Mordecai said.
Ein be'adma,
he replied.
Don't mention it.
The Israeli smiled.
You speak Hebrew?
A little.
Have you been to Israel?
Once or twice,
Harvath lied. He had been there many times.
Business or pleasure?
Are you interrogating me, Mr. Mordecai?
Please, call me Bensi.
So, this is a recruitment then?
Mordecai winked at him.
That depends. Are you recruitable?
No, he's not,
said Nicholas from behind his laptop. Bensi leaned in closer and whispered to Harvath.
It would drive me crazy working with him.
He's changed.
The Israeli laughed.
Even the smallest of leopards do not change their spots.
Trust me, this one has. And a word of advice, don't make short jokes.
He's that sensitive?
Harvath gestured toward Argos and Draco.
And these two haven't eaten all day.
I've heard stories about his dogs. All true.
Mordecai shook his head and kept his voice low.
Primordial dwarfism. He should be dead by now.
So should we. Yet here we are.
The Israeli nodded, conceding the point. After taking a long sip of water, he changed the subject.
What's going to happen to Damien?
That depends on what your colleagues back in Tel Aviv pull off the mirror of his hard drive. Mordecai curled and uncurled his free hand.
Arthritis? Harvath asked.
He nodded.
Courtesy of Mahmoud al-Mabou.
What did you do? Break both of your hands against his head trying to help him get into a police car? Harvath expected a smile from the Israeli, but he didn't get one. Instead, Mordecai replied,
Many years ago, there was a member of the Knesset. He was popular in Israel, particularly when it came to his opinions on Gaza and the West Bank. He was a good man, a fair man. Even a majority of Palestinians liked him. He seemed poised not only to become prime minister, but to achieve something even more important. Peace.
As peace had yet to come to Israel, Harvath knew the Knesset members' attempts had somehow been dashed and waited for Mordecai to explain.
The man had two daughters, he said, taking another drink of water. Beautiful girls. Young, stupid, beautiful girls.
They liked going out to clubs and they liked doing drugs. They were Israeli royalty who could do no wrong. Their father was warned repeatedly about their behavior, but their celebrity fed his as much as his fed theirs. It was the dysfunctional epitome of a vicious cycle. Instead of throttling back even a little so that he could focus on his family, he admonished his daughters and turned his attention right back to his own career. Harvath had seen the same thing in many American political families. In a culture obsessed with likes, shares, and number of followers, politics had become the ultimate social media contest where a man like Abraham Lincoln could never get off the ground without a Guy Fawkes mask.
As is typical for children who have no boundaries, the girls were constantly in search of where the line was. How far could they actually go before their parents stepped in and lowered the proverbial boom?
The mother, a popular Israeli television star with a fledgling pop music career, was worthless. She was the one who set the bad example for the girls. Liquor, drugs, and rumors of an affair with not one, but two of her co-stars. The family was a disaster. And then, things got really bad. As the father was focused on his upcoming campaign, and the mother on her new album, the girls were left with zero supervision. They fell in with an even worse crowd and got involved with harder and harder drugs, in search of higher and higher highs. One night, they wrapped their father's BMW around a tree. That should have been a wake-up call to everyone, right?
Harvath nodded. Except it wasn't, Mordecai replied.
Their parents, scotch-filled highballs in hand, hypocritically railed against the girls' exorbitant lifestyles. As you might imagine, the brats returned fire. According to the put-upon neighbors, it was a battle of epic proportions. Desperate to find, as well as to exert some vestige of his withering parental authority, the father opted to go nuclear. In a move that could only be appreciated by some feckless bureaucrat, he declared his daughter's finances frozen. Harvath looked at him.
That was it? He didn't ground them. He didn't sign them up for forced labor at the world's worst kibbutz. He just took away their credit cards?
Mordecai shook his head.
Didn't even take their car keys.
So basically, his daughters still went out on the town. They were now just dependent upon other people to help provide their fun. The Israeli nodded.
And guess who was right there, ready to provide it?
Harvath looked at the man, flexing his hands, and sensed the answer.
Hamas?
Once again, Mordecai nodded.
The last thing they wanted was peace, and those drug-addled, self-important children provided them the perfect opportunity to knock it all off course.
Inside the bowels of Hamas is a desk occupied by a little mouse of a man. We only have second and third-hand accounts, but by all of them, he is an effeminate Francophile who codenamed his operation Colette. Are you familiar with Truffaut?
François Truffaut, the French filmmaker? Harvath asked.
That's him. Hamas's mouse named his operation after one of Truffaut's films, Antoine and Colette. It's an insipid French story about unrequited love between two attractive young teens in Paris. The mouse chose the name Colette for what is essentially a glorified Palestinian modeling agency. Unfortunately, in Israel, there is no end to spoiled, privileged children looking to rebel against their parents. Our two Knesset princesses were no exception. When Daddy cut up the credit cards, they turned to other means to fund their fun. Because they had developed such a dangerous appetite for getting high, they had also developed a dangerous tolerance for risk in the pursuit of reaching those highs. One night, that pursuit led them out of Israel proper and into Gaza. Harvath's expression must have said it all, because Mordecai shared with him a heavy, sorrow-laden glance and bowed his head and said, "The girls had been befriended by two extremely handsome boys, hand-picked by the little Palestinian Francophile. The boys provided a steady pipeline of drugs, and though they applied no pressure whatsoever, the girls fell into bed with them, eager to make sure the party train continued to roll. Then, finally one night, with their trust and dependency secured, the boys informed them that they were zipping into Gaza to pick up more drugs and needed their help. Getting into Gaza wasn't the problem. Getting back through the Israeli checkpoint was. With the girls' good looks, family name, and low-cut tops, it wouldn't be a problem at all." It was amazing how many people in pursuit of the next high tossed all common sense aside and fell for this kind of bullshit ruse. It pissed Harvath off to no end, but the fact that the girl's father wasn't there to protect them from this pissed him off even more. What kind of a man doesn't protect his children from wolves? Harvath didn't care what the Knesset man's greater aspirations for Israel were. If he couldn't protect his own family, how the hell could he ever be expected to help protect his own nation? For a moment, Harvath was thrust into the man's shoes. Wasn't this the exact thing he worried about? How could he ever protect a family of his own while he was a world away trying to protect his country from the next threat or terrorist attack? But when they arrived in Gaza, Mordecai continued, there were no drugs waiting to be picked up. It was an ambush. Mahmoud al-Mabou's men did unspeakable things to the girls, videotaping all of it, and leaving their bloodied and defiled bodies on a road outside Nablus. The father must have been enraged. First, he was in denial. Then he was in shock. Then came the rage, and it burned white hot. Al-Mabou and Hamas had succeeded. The fighting would continue. The greatest instrument for peace either side had seen in a generation was now solely focused on revenge. Which is where you come in, said Harvath. Correct? Mordecai nodded. The atrocity committed by Hamas was unforgivable and could only be repaid in blood. Even the doves of the Knesset wanted revenge. I was with Shin Bet at the time, the Special Operations Unit.
Yamas, Harvath said.
Correct. Our focus was to locate and eliminate terrorists inside Israel, Gaza, and the West Bank. We had a reputation for being able to get them anywhere, anytime. We even carried out strikes in broad daylight. No place was safe for them. It took us a year to track down all of the men responsible. Once we did, we spent another 3 months training and planning the missions to take them out. The only operation that failed was mine.
You missed your target?
We got our target, but because of some bad intelligence, my team zigged when it should have zagged. The three men with me were killed. I was captured. Al-Mabou personally oversaw my torture. As part of that torture, each one of my fingers was bent back until it snapped. Once the bones began to heal, they would repeat the process. The pain was unlike anything I have ever known. As if the torture were not bad enough, not being able to use my hands to feed myself or conduct other necessities was a demoralizing indignity. Harvath had heard some sadistic POW stories in his time, and this one ranked right up there.
How long were you in captivity?
It was 7 months before I was rescued.
That's a long time.
At first, they weren't even sure I was alive, but once they figured out I was, they worked day and night to get me back. Israel never once gave up on me. The Israelis were incredibly loyal to their warriors. It spoke to the character of their nation, and was something Harvath had always admired. It was one of many reasons that explained the close kinship America and Israel enjoyed. As the only democracy in the Middle East, Israel mirrored many of America's values. Now that Harvath understood the barbarity of Mordecai's captivity, and that it had been overseen by Al-Mabu, it was clear why the Israeli had been so angry with Nicholas. Harvath was about to ask the little man what was taking so long with the memory card, when Nicholas looked up from his keyboard and said,
"We may have a problem."
Chapter 41.
"Wait a second," Mordecai replied, leaning in to look at Nicholas's screen.
"She erased everything?"
"How much information can you extract from it?" Harvath asked.
"Not much," the little man replied. "How do I know I can believe you?" said Mordecai.
"You shouldn't," Nicholas said,
removing the memory card and handing it to him.
"Your IT people in Tel Aviv will tell you the same thing. She used a pretty sophisticated product to scrub the data, but they'll back up what I'm telling you."
"Why would she erase all of the earlier keystrokes she had captured and only give us the most recent?"
"You tell me. There's a lot of memory space available on that card. She could have stored keystrokes for years. It's not like she needed to continually free up space."
Harvath looked at Mordecai. "You said her op was taking longer than it should have, and you were concerned that she had fallen for Damien and didn't want to go through with it. That's why you offered up the sex trafficking leader. But what if Helena had another agenda? What if she didn't want you to have all of the keystrokes she had captured?"
Mordecai was smart enough to know that you never really knew people, but he thought he knew Helena. The idea that she might be pursuing an alternate agenda had never entered into his mind. But it should have. Maybe she was that good of an actress. Maybe she had fooled everybody, even him.
It was a lot to process, but what mattered most at the moment, though, was transmitting the information from the memory card back to Israel.
"I'm going to need my laptop," said Mordecai.
Nicholas removed it from the cubby he was sitting next to and handed it over.
"I hope you didn't waste too much time going through it. There isn't anything on it."
"Didn't even power it up," the little man said, writing down the access code for the Wi-Fi in his van and giving it to him.
Mordecai doubted that.
"The laptop is a burner, as are the websites and email addresses I am about to use."
"Best practices. I wouldn't expect anything less."
The man was a pro, and Nicholas had been telling the truth when he said he expected nothing less of him. While operatives like Mordecai can and did make mistakes, it was highly unlikely at his level. If there had been anything on his computer, it would have been highly suspicious, so much so that Nicholas would have considered it a trap, purposely meant to be uncovered. What's more, Mordecai and the Mossad were smart enough to know that the United States had grown beyond unreasonable with personal electronics searches at points of entry, even demanding that returning American citizens hand over passwords to their encrypted data or be thrown in prison. It was out of control and something President Porter had vowed to fix. Mordecai jumped through the digital hoops of preparing the data from Helena's memory card. It would be routed through a false front website to a special cloud server that had been established by the Mossad's technology department in conjunction with Unit 8200, Israel's Ministry of Defense Signal Intelligence Division, akin to the NSA. Once the data was ready, he began the transmission. If Damien's hard drive held what the Mossad hoped it held, they would know the extent of his plans and be able to set the wheels in motion to stop him. If it didn't, he had no idea what they were going to do next. There was no doubt in his mind that Damien's weaponized hemorrhagic fever was incredibly lethal. To meet his goal of slicing the world's population from over 7 billion to under 500 million, it would have to be the worst plague mankind had ever known. And what bothered him the most was that, as forthright as he had been with them, his American counterparts appeared to be holding back on him. As if he needed any further proof, Nicholas motioned for Harvath, and only Harvath, to look at something on his screen. Once Harvath had seen it, he summoned Palmer and Ashby over to the van.
"How much money do you have on you?"
he asked Palmer.
"Couple of $100," he replied. "Why?"
"Any credit cards?"
Palmer nodded.
"I want you to max them out," he said,
pulling up a website on his phone and texting the link to his colleague.
"Get as many things on this list as possible."
SHTFplan.com? The top 100 items that disappear first in an emergency? What's going on?"
"I'll explain later," Harvath replied. "Hit the home improvement store first and then go next door to Target. Make sure to top off your gas tank. Bring all of it to my place."
Mordecai looked at him.
"What's happening?"
"The virus is spreading," he said.
Turning to Ashby, he pointed to the PetSmart.
"Nicholas will text you what he needs for the dogs. Get it, get gas, and then get Mr. Mordecai to my place and wait for me there."
"Your place? Are you sure about that?"
"Positive. Now get moving."
The Israeli held up his laptop.
"I haven't heard anything back yet."
"We'll get you set up on my network when we get there," Harvath replied. "Now let's go."
Exiting the van, they slid the door shut as Nicholas tapped out a quick list for Ashby and then climbed into the driver's seat and fired it up.
"How reliable are the numbers you just got?"
Harvath asked as he slid into the passenger seat next to him.
"They're straight out of the CDC's EpiX. It's the most current and up to date."
"Damn it."
The virus had now appeared in 11 more cities.
"There's something else," Nicholas said,
as he put the vehicle in gear and navigated out to the road.
"Those initials, MC, the ones Damien had scrawled on his outcome conference document, I know what they stand for."
"You do? How?"
"It was part of the keystroke data that Helena captured. While Linda Landon was in the room with Damien, she accessed something. MC refers to a FEMA database called Main Core."
"I've never heard of it," replied Harvath. "Do you know what it is?"
"I've only heard rumors about it. It was supposedly developed in the 1980s as part of the United States Continuity of Government Plan. It is a list classified above top secret with over 10 million American names. These Americans have been classified as potential threats to national security. In the event of a national emergency, each person has been pre-ranked for surveillance, questioning, or even detention."
"What lands them on the list to begin with?"
"Usually, disagreeing with the government."
"Like being anti-war?" Harvath asked.
"Or you can be anti-universal health care. It is a completely nonpartisan list. It doesn't care how you vote. All that matters is that you are perceived as a threat to the government in some form or another."
"So, just by attending a Code Pink or a Tea Party rally, you wind up on the list?"
"From what I have read, you have to do more than just attend the rally, although it wouldn't surprise me if it kept lists like that too. To land on Main Core, you'd have to have a more active role in a movement. The concept, as I understand it, is that the government would want to know where to find you in a time of national unrest in order to make sure that you weren't contributing to that unrest."
"And if I was?" Harvath asked indignantly.
"Then you'd be silenced."
"How?"
Nicholas shrugged.
"I didn't write the plan, but I think you get the idea. Certain people are going to need more pressure applied than others. If you have a bad enough event take place, if something like martial law is imposed, then habeas corpus can be tossed out the window, and your rights don't mean anything You get thrown in a cell, and that's that.
Except, we wouldn't call it martial law. We use the term state of national emergency, Harvath replied.
Correct. And under a state of national emergency, Congress can be bypassed, and an incredible array of extraordinary powers get swept into the Oval Office. Just for starters, property and commodities could be seized. Private sector businesses could be told what to do and how to do it. All means of transportation and communication could be taken over. The list goes on and on. It's quite remarkable how quickly a democratic republic could cease being democratic.
But sometimes in an emergency, if it's bad enough, certain things are necessary, kind of like the way blood in the body races to protect the internal organs.
I'm not arguing, said Nicholas. I'm just laying out the facts. That's a lot of power to concentrate in one location. And based upon what we know of Damien and who we saw leaving his estate, I think we've got more than a little reason for concern.
Never let a good crisis go to waste, Harbath deadpanned, quoting a former White House chief of staff.
Exactly. By all accounts, Maine Corps is nothing more than an enemies list. It incorporates people from across the ideological spectrum who are united by one thing, opposition to the federal government. The list exists only to identify and quash dissent. The First Amendment notwithstanding, what if that dissent is warranted? What if some of those voices are valuable, particularly at a time of national crisis?
Harvath had heard the federal government likened to the Star Wars character Jabba the Hutt. It sat in Washington, D.C., gorging itself and increasing in size. If you suggested it go on a diet or you threatened it in any way, it would send bounty hunters like Boba Fett after you in the form of multitudinous federal agencies, which no longer served the citizens, but were part and parcel of Jabba and only concerned about protecting themselves. Nicholas's question about the value of certain dissenting voices concerned him. In the 1970s, a senator named Frank Church had begun to ring the alarm bell about the incredible surveillance capabilities the United States was building. When focused outward on the rest of the world, America's giant listening ears were unbelievably valuable. But the senator warned of a day that might come when those ears would be turned inward on the American people. That was exactly what had happened in the wake of the 9/11 attacks. Church's biggest concern was that under the banner of protecting the American people, the federal government would pursue more and more invasive means of gathering, sifting, sorting, and storing personal information and private communications. He referred to it as crossing the Rubicon and warned that if, even generations hence, the U.S. government ever began tilting toward tyranny, it would be impossible to mount any form of resistance whatsoever. Such was the government's ability to read everything, listen to everything, and know everything before it even happened.
So how does Maine Corps help Damien? Harvath asked.
To understand that, Nicholas replied, we're going to need to get a look at who's on the list.
Chapter 42. Harvath had called ahead to alert Lara that people were going to begin showing up at the house. By the time he and Nicholas arrived, the old man's vehicle was already parked in the drive. Harvath's home, as well as the surrounding acreage, had been deeded to him as a thank you by a prior U.S. president. In exchange for his $1 per annum rent, Harvath was expected to maintain the historical property in a manner befitting and contributing to its stature. Overlooking the Potomac, and just south of George Washington's Mount Vernon estate, sat Bishop's Gate, a stubby yet elegant stone church and rectory. During the Revolutionary War, it had been home to an outspoken Anglican priest and dedicated loyalist who had given aid and comfort to British spies. As a result, the church was attacked by the colonial army and left in ruins. Bishop's Gate remained that way until the late 1800s, when it was taken over by the United States Navy, renovated, and repurposed as a covert training center for the Office of Naval Intelligence. Eventually, the ONI outgrew the facility, and after a short stint storing dead files, it was relegated to mothball status. Although not as upscale as some of the other properties in the Navy's portfolio, its location was exceptional, as was its access to the water. The history of the estate, though, was what had won Harvath over. On his very first exploration of the rectory attic, he had discovered a beautiful hand-carved sign. Upon it had been written the motto of the Anglican missionaries, Transiens adjuvanos, I go overseas to give help. It was as if it had been carved expressly for him. The moment Harvath had seen it, he had known that he was home. It had taken some doing, but he had gotten the place into great shape. He was good with his hands and knew his way around a toolbox. Fixing things was becoming a lost art. When Lara visited with her son Marco, Harvath liked to find projects for the two of them to do together. He had even gotten him his own little boy-sized tool set. It gave him no end of joy to see the sense of pride and accomplishment in Marco when he successfully completed one of their tasks together. He was a good boy. Entering the house, Harvath and Nicholas passed the Anglican missionary sign in the entry hall and walked toward the sound of voices in the kitchen. Argos and Draco trotted ahead. Nicholas spent a lot of time at Bishop's Gate, and the dogs knew their way around. It had become like a second home to them. Carlton was seated at the kitchen table, a cup of coffee in front of him. Lara was leaning against the kitchen counter, smiling, a cup of coffee in her hand, and something simmering on the stove behind her.
That smells good, he said, kissing her.
Arroz Karatehu, your favorite.
Both of Lara's parents were amazing cooks, and they had passed on their love of cooking to her. Arroz Karatehu, which roughly translated into rice wagoner or cart riders, was a popular dish from southern Brazil. Meat, rice, tomato, onions, and spices. It was perfect for this time of year. Grabbing a cup of coffee, he looked at Nicholas, who nodded. After pouring coffee for each of them, he suggested to Carlton that they walk back to his study. It was one of his favorite rooms in the house. Here, he stored his vast library and floor-to-ceiling bookcases. There was an old desk, a large fireplace, a leather sofa, and two comfortable side chairs. He motioned for his guests to find a place to sit while he looked for his remote and powered on the television.
Have you heard about the new cases? Harvath asked.
Carlton nodded. But that's not the worst part of it.
Why? What's going on?
The dead ones, the ones who bled out, all of them traveled to Saudi Arabia for the Hajj. The bad news is that hospital emergency rooms, minute clinics, and family doctors across numerous cities are now reporting a surge in patients who haven't traveled outside the United States, but who are presenting with high fevers and other symptoms believed to be consistent with the initial stages of African hemorrhagic fever.
Damn it, Harvath replied.
His instincts to send Palmer to stock up on supplies had been well-founded. Though he always kept his pantry stocked and would be able to take care of a certain number of visitors for an extended period during an emergency, nobody in their right mind would pass up getting one last crack at the stores before they were overrun and stripped bare. All you had to do was ask anyone in a hurricane zone whether it was better to be 2 minutes early to the grocery store in advance of a storm or 2 minutes late. There is something else, the old man added. And it doesn't get repeated outside this room. But President Porter has developed a fever. Out of an abundance of caution, he's been transported to Bethesda Naval Hospital for observation.
He said it was just a cold, Harvath replied. Has he had contact with anyone who recently traveled to Mecca?
He's the president. He has contact with a lot of people.
Including us.
The old man knew what he was suggesting. Not that they had potentially infected Porter, but that he may have infected them. All the more reason we need to get moving, said Carlton. We've got a lot of work to do. Let's start by you giving me an update on what happened in Winchester. Harvath walked the old man through all of it, with Nicholas filling in where appropriate. At one point, Carlton stopped him and asked, "What do you think this Helena woman was erasing from that memory card?"
"If I had to guess," said Nicholas, "I'd say passwords. Damien is a smart man. We should assume he changes his passwords often."
"But her assignment was to get his password, period. Once she had done that, why didn't she send it to Mordecai and pull up stakes?"
"Again, if I had to guess, I'd say she had been accessing Damien's computer from early on in the operation. Whenever he changed his password, she'd have to recapture it in order to get back in."
"For what, though?" Carlton pushed. "All the Mossad wanted was the password. They didn't ask her to extract anything from the man's laptop."
Nicholas put up his hands.
"I'm the zeros and ones guy. I don't attempt to assess or explain human motivations."
"Bullshit, Nick. Stop screwing around. Why do you think she kept hitting his hard drive?"
There was only one answer that came to his mind.
"Money."
Slowly, Carlton nodded. He liked that answer. It was simple. More important, it made sense.
"Okay, so let's say it was money. How does access to Damien's hard drive make her money?"
"Without seeing his hard drive, I can't tell you."
"As we don't have access to it, why don't you take a guess?"
The little man shrugged.
"I can think of a million ways to monetize what might be on the personal hard drive of a man like Pierre Damien. Was there anything that could be used to blackmail him or other powerful figures? Were there any soon-to-be-released reports about drugs Damien's pharmaceutical companies were working on? How about the status of pipeline or drilling agreements for his oil or natural gas companies?"
"Okay," said the old man, "but if you know, like Helena, that Damien has something massive planned, something he hopes is going to totally reshape the world, do you really care about some new Alzheimer's drug, some pipeline deal with Kurdistan, or some nude island frequented by some second-rate British royal?"
"No," Nicholas answered.
"Why?"
"First of all, if there was any blackmail material on the laptop, she should have been able to find it on her first pass through. That leaves financial material. And you're right. If Damien is going to crash the world as we know it, there's no value in knowing about some miracle Alzheimer's drug or pipeline deal before it happens."
"Unless," said Harbath.
Both Nicholas and Carlton looked at him. "Unless what?" the old man asked.
"Unless her goal was to profit from the crash."
"How?"
"Suppose the Mossad was right," Harbath continued, "but only half right. Suppose Helena did want out, but that instead of Pierre Damien being her golden ticket, he unknowingly helped her pack her parachute."
"Meaning what?" Carlton replied. "She was funneling cash from his accounts?"
"No, too easy to get caught. Let's assume she's smarter than that."
"If she was smarter than that, she would have stopped being a honey trap for the Mossad a long time ago."
Harvath held up his hand. "Damien is a lot of crazy things, but we all agree he isn't stupid. He's also a successful businessman. A businessman sitting on the biggest piece of insider information ever. He knows the exact date the world is going to end. Why in God's name wouldn't he play that?"
The old man's eyes widened. "Short the market?"
"There are lots of things he could be up to. Helena, though, would have to know where and when to place her bets. She'd need to get out before everything collapsed. That might be why she has been accessing Damien's laptop. She's trying to catch a falling knife."
"Good way to feather your nest if you were planning to leave the Mossad and disappear."
"Speaking of which," Harvath replied as his driveway alarm chimed and one of the outdoor camera feeds popped up on his TV. "Sloane's here with Mordecai."
"What should we do with him?"
"I think we should read him in on everything we've got," said Harvath.
"Everything?"
He nodded. "All of it."
Chapter 43 Mordecai accepted a cup of tea and moved a bit closer to the fire Harvath had started for him in the fireplace. As the wood sizzled and popped, he listened to Harvath lay everything out. When he had finished, The first thing that came to mind to say was,
"Thank you."
"You're welcome," Harvath replied. "All we ask is that you don't broadcast to your people that President Porter has been taken to Bethesda. If that gets out, it will cause a panic."
"When it comes to causing a panic, I think there are one or two other things you should be more concerned about."
"And we are. We just don't want to contribute to a deteriorating situation."
"I understand," Mordecai said. "In the event the president is unable to execute his duties, who takes over? The vice president, correct?"
"Correct."
"And if the vice president happens to become ill?"
"Then the Speaker of the House, followed by the president pro tempore of the Senate," Harvath replied.
"And then cabinet members," Carlton added. "Secretary of State, all the way down to the Secretary of Homeland Security."
"Which is where Linda Landon works," said Mordecai.
Harvath had his laptop open on his desk, and he pulled up the United States presidential line of succession to show him.
"But if the vice president is number one," he said, "Homeland Security is all the way down here at the bottom at number 17, and that's for the current acting secretary. Not only would he have to fall ill, but so would several other people at DHS before she could ever hope to ascend to the secretary position."
Mordecai shrugged.
"If the virus moves fast enough."
It was almost too crazy to believe. Sickening everyone above you in order to seize the Oval Office? But maybe there was something to it. Palace coups had used poison throughout history, so why not disease? Was that why Damien was rubbing elbows with all the backbencher bureaucrats? Was it more than just securing the reins of power in the White House? Was it a means by which to control the federal government from tip to tail? It all came back to how Damien intended for the survivors of African hemorrhagic fever to actually survive. If they could figure that out, then maybe they could reverse engineer the plot. Harvath looked at Carlton.
"Who do we have at Homeland Security that we can trust?"
"I can think of one or two people, but it depends on the task. Are you looking for background on Linda Landon? Inter-office chatter, that kind of thing?" He shook his head.
"No. Word might leak, and like we said, she'll run to Damien. Right now, I'm more concerned with the people above her. Specifically, I want to know if any of them are sick."
The old man thought about it for a second and then said, "I have someone I can call."
"Good. Do it," Harvath replied.
Turning to Mordecai, he asked,
"What do you need?"
Tapping the laptop he had brought in with him, he said, "Wi-Fi access."
"No problem. Anything else?"
"I'd also like my phone back so that I can call my people and bring them up to speed."
Harvath looked at Carlton and the old man nodded.
"Done."
He called to Sloane and asked her to bring Mordecai's cell phone in. He then created a hotspot, firewalled off from all of his devices, and gave the man a temporary password. As Carlton stepped out of the room to call his contact at DHS, Nicholas asked,
"What do you need from me?"
"How long would it take you to get inside that main core database and give me a 30,000-foot view?"
The little man looked down at his chronograph, activated the stopwatch, and said,
"Let's find out."
Sliding off the couch, he picked up his coffee, whistled for the dogs, and headed for the front door. He worked better without other people around, and the van had everything he needed. Now, the only person without a designated assignment was Harvath. That didn't mean, though, that he didn't have something to do. He had a huge task in front of him, and it began in the kitchen. He quietly asked Sloane to remain in the study with Mordecai. He also asked her to use her phone to covertly record any conversations the Israeli conducted over his cell phone. Harvath's Hebrew wasn't good enough to help translate them later, but Nicholas would have access to a program that could do it. With Sloane giving her marching orders, Harvath went to speak with Lara. She had the TV on. She was a news junkie like him. Even if she were not, today was the kind of day where everyone began turning on television sets, looking to pick up the latest information, wondering if the breaking news was going to impact them. Harvath knew that it was going to impact everyone.
"Not good," she said,
nodding toward the TV.
I know, he replied. We need to talk.
Lara wiped her hands on a kitchen towel and poured herself a cup of coffee. Raising the pot, she looked to see if Harvath wanted some.
Please, he said with a nod.
Lara brought it over to the kitchen table, warmed up his cup, and sat down next to him.
How bad is it?
She asked.
Bad. How the hell are you right in the middle of it?
He smiled.
I'm worried about Marco, she continued, and my parents.
So am I. That's what I want to talk with you about. I've made arrangements for you all to be taken someplace safe.
Where?
Alaska.
Alaska?
Lara repeated.
Good friends of mine have a fishing lodge there. It's in the middle of nowhere. He's a SEAL, and his wife is very squared away. They know what they're doing. You'll all be safe there.
What about you?
Unfortunately, I have to stay behind. But I'm going to be okay. I'm going to put Nicholas in a backpack and stuff my pockets with bacon so the dogs don't leave my side.
Lara attempted a smile, her eyes cast toward the floor. He raised her chin until she was looking at him.
It's going to be okay, he repeated. Does it have to be you?
He nodded.
Why?
You know why.
She turned away from him, but he gently turned her back. Her eyes were moist. He had never seen her cry.
Everything is going to be okay, he said again. Come with us.
I can't.
Yes, you can. Porter has the whole government at his beck and call. Scientists, the military. Let's just go. Let's outrun it.
He pulled her to him and held her tighter than he had ever held her before. They stayed like that for several minutes. It was long enough for their breathing to fall into sync. Finally, she pushed away from him. As she did, she hit him right in the center of his chest as hard as she could and said, "Fuck you." She was a cop. Tough. She knew how to make it hurt. And it did.
Ugh!
Harvath groaned. She stared at him, angry.
Fuck you? He teased. I haven't learned that one yet. Is it Brazilian Portuguese or Portuguese Portuguese?
Lara smiled. This time, it was genuine.
You need to understand that I'm doing this for you. For you and for Marco, he said. And for your parents.
It had felt hollow as it took shape in his mind, but as soon as it touched his lips, he realized that he meant it.
There isn't anybody else who can do this, he continued. Not now. Nicholas, me, Reed, Sloan, Chase, we're it.
Look, he said as he directed her attention back to the TV.
People are already dying, and it kills me that I couldn't help them. The only thing I can do right now is try to protect everyone else.
But you can't protect everyone.
I can try. I need to.
Stroking the side of his cheek, she leaned in and kissed him.
I love you too, she said.
Harvath pulled her into him and kissed her back. Closing his eyes, he drank her in, the way she felt, the way she kissed, the way she smelled. He tried to freeze everything about her. He tried to create a snapshot that would always be there whenever he needed her. He didn't want the moment to end, but it did when Carlton soundlessly slipped into the kitchen and cleared his throat. Disentangling himself from Lara, Harvath looked up.
I just got off the phone with my contact at Homeland Security, the old man said. It's bad.
Chapter 44.
You've got to be kidding me, said Harvath. All the top-tier management? The PASC through the SES?
It was Washington speak for presidential-appointed Senate-confirmed staff through senior executive service staff.
They're not sure it's all of them yet, but it's enough, and it's not just at Homeland Security.
Let me guess, Harvath replied. HHS, OPM, DOT, USAID, Treasury, the FCC, DOJ. What am I missing?
Carlton filled in several others.
Department of State, Department of Defense, Department of the Interior, Agriculture, Commerce, Labor, Housing and Urban Development, DOE, FBI, the VA, it's everywhere.
All of them have lost their upper management.
No, some have, some haven't. But all are starting to report attrition up and down the chains. I just asked Nick to work up a spreadsheet.
A spreadsheet? Harvath replied, separating himself from Lara and standing up from the table. We need him focused on digging into Main Corps. Have Sloan work up your spreadsheet.
He hated throwing Ashby under the bus like that, but there was no reason why she couldn't sit in Harvath's study with the old man, keeping one eye on Mordecai and using her other to build a spreadsheet. Looking at Lara, Harvath said,
Tell your parents to get packed, winter clothes. Have them put together a bag for you and for Marco, too. I'm sending a plane to Logan to pick them up. Do you have somebody who can get them to the airport?
Lara nodded.
I can call someone from Boston PD.
Good. She wanted to discuss it further, but before she could find the right words, Harvath had already left the kitchen and was headed back down the hall to his study. The first person he locked eyes with when he walked in was Mordecai.
Anything?
The Israeli shook his head.
The password Helena provided for the hard drive doesn't work.
I think Nicholas was correct.
Damien has probably changed it since we made our copy.
So where does that leave us?
We obviously need to talk to Helena.
Obviously, thought Harvath, but she was over an hour's drive away.
What about the cell phone?
At least there we have good news. When Damien met with Linda Landon, we believe he gave her her own private cell phone. In the process of getting her set up, he turned his on and entered his password. The keystroke recorder caught it.
So were you able to open the mirror you have back in Israel?
Mordecai nodded.
Unlike his laptop, Damien hasn't changed the password on his mystery phone.
What does it contain?
The man turned his laptop around so everyone could see the screen. It showed a map of the world with throbbing red dots in a number of countries.
The phones are part of a small, highly encrypted digital network.
Can you zoom the map onto the U.S.?
The Israeli obliged, hovering just above a red dot near Winchester, Virginia, and another in the District of Columbia.
Damien and Linda Landon.
Your people should be able to confirm, he said, but yes, that's who we believe we are looking at.
And the other dots? Harvath asked.
If I had to put money on it, replied Mordecai, I would guess the other phones represent the other members of Damien's plenary panel.
Harvath looked at Carlton, who had already been tumbling the technicalities and diplomatic consequences in his mind. The good news, Carlton slowly stated, is that the agency has operatives in each of these countries. The bad news is that the countries are all American allies.
So what?
So this isn't like taking out some jihadist or rolling up a terror financier. This is a different ball game, a completely different set of rules. We're talking about citizens of allied nations who are diplomats, ranking members of the UN. It was the president's Pierre Damien argument all over again. Looking at the old man, he said,
Let's pass this phone data to Ryan and let the agency decide what they want to do. At least it should help them ID the plenary panel.
We're going to want to be involved with that too, Mordecai responded.
Of course they would. And at this point, that was fine by Harvath. The more hands on deck, the better. His bigger issue, though, was what to do next. With the president at Bethesda and the virus taking off, they needed a break. A big one. He was tempted to ignore Porter's orders and go snatch Damien right now. Landon, too. They didn't have time to sit around and hope that something turned in their favor. Just before pulling into his driveway, Harvath had received a text from Ash. He and his team were on the ground in Kinshasa and had hooked up with the star team member Colonel White had assigned to them. They were already prepping for how they were going to hit the WHO lab there and recover the samples of Yusuf Makulu, the mysterious Muslim man who had shown up and collapsed at the Matoumeni clinic. Other star team members, based on the map coordinates Harvath had provided,
were searching for the corpse of the rebel commander, while still more had met up with Jambo back in Bunia in an attempt to track down Leonce and his son to get blood and tissue samples from them to confirm that all the cases were connected. Even once those had been secured, they would need to be flown back for analysis. There was no telling what condition things would be in by then. USAMRID was already examining samples secured from the CDC. Unlike in the movies, it took a long time to produce a vaccine. Scientists had been studying some viruses forever, and there still were no effective vaccines for them. Harvath, though normally optimistic, wasn't very hopeful that USAMRID would come up with something in time.
"Can we speak about Main Corps?" Mordecai asked, interrupting Harvath's train of thought. "We all agree that this is likely what the MC and Damien's handwritten notes referred to."
Harvath nodded.
"Based on what Linda Landon was typing, yes."
"Back in Tel Aviv, no one thought Main Corps actually existed. They believed it was just a conspiracy theory."
"Well, they were wrong," Nicholas interrupted, as he padded back into the study, along with his laptop and his two gigantic dogs.
"You're already in?" Harvath asked.
"Guess who doesn't change her passwords as often as Damien?" the little man asked, as he tossed his computer onto the couch and climbed up after it.
"Linda Landon."
Nicholas smiled and set the computer on his lap.
"I still don't understand the purpose of this list," said Mordecai. "The United States keeps a list of its own dissidents? Doesn't this contradict your vaunted constitutional principles?"
Harvath couldn't tell if it was a veiled shot or a sincere question. He decided to give him the benefit of the doubt when Nicholas jumped in and spoke up.
"The Constitution has always been meant as a check on government power. Proponents of larger government have lamented that it enshrines a set of negative liberties, specifically by detailing what the government can't do to you, rather than what the government should do for you. The founders envisioned a limited government, particularly on the federal level, but over time it has grown, essentially into its own living, breathing organism, whose prime directive, if you will, is its own continuing survival. That's where Main Corps comes in. The name comes from the fact that it was a database designed to bring together disparate pieces of data from across the commercial, judicial, and law enforcement spectrums, and fuse them into a main file, or main core of information, if you will. Importance was placed on that information that would help the government immediately track you down if it wanted you. The data has evolved from credit card receipts and utility bills in the 1980s to social media relationships and cell phone location data today. The government, under the guise of, we'd never use it, but it's better to have it and not need it than to need it and not have it, has created several different database systems that very clearly violate the country's constitutional principles. Of those, Main Corps is one of the most insidious.
How does it work?
If a state of national emergency is declared, the Main Corps database can be activated. Within the database, citizens are ranked as to the level of threat they are deemed to pose. Recommendations ranging from covertly monitoring communications to apprehension accompany each name. Citizens marked for apprehension are color-coded, based on the danger they are expected to pose the arrest team.
Nicholas's eyes met Harvath's and remained.
What?
Your name's on the list.
For what?
The little man shrugged.
It doesn't say why. But somebody sees you as a serious threat to national security in a time of crisis.
That's ridiculous.
Is it? How many senators have you pissed off? How many members of Congress? How many intelligence officials? I'm not saying you weren't right. I'm just saying you have pissed off a lot of people over the years. Apparently, somebody took it very personally.
So take my name off the list.
I tried.
Try again.
I can't, said Nicholas.
Why not?
Because it flagged your file and locked me out.
Harvath looked at him.
What's that mean?
I don't know.
What do you mean, you don't know?
Nicholas was exasperated and embarrassed at the same time.
I tripped something, and suddenly I was swarmed.
Swarmed by what?
I don't know, but they knew what they were doing. They were all over me. They were doing things I had never seen before. Not only were they trying to capture my information, they were trying to trap me so that I couldn't get out.
Out of a database? Harvath replied. Why didn't you just kick the cord out of the wall?
Seriously?
Of course not, but you understand what I'm saying.
And you're not understanding what I'm saying. I have never seen anything this sophisticated. Not with a bank, not with a military, and definitely not with a government.
Nicholas was upset, and Harvath couldn't remember ever seeing him like this.
Relax, he said. It's all going to be okay.
I hope so.
Hope so, said Harvath.
You peeled off your name tag before you wandered into their database, right?
I always do. In fact, I put on somebody else's.
Now it was Carlton's turn to chime in. Nicholas had a bad habit of where he chose to make it look like his hacks had originated from. Where this time?
Second Director's Office, FSB in Moscow.
The old man thought about it, jutted his bottom lip out, and then nodded. I don't have a problem with that.
Just as long as it doesn't link back to you, Harvath stated.
Nicholas didn't say anything.
It's not going to link back to you, is it?
Normally, I'd say no. But these guys weren't normal. I don't know what to say.
Harvath looked at his watch and wondered if it was too early for a drink. He was starting to get a headache, which reminded him he needed to take his temperature again and text it to the doctor. Of all the stupid things to have to remember to do, this one took the cake. But the old man had insisted and had been riding him like a jockey about it. Excusing himself, he exited the study and jogged upstairs to his master bath. Removing the thermometer from the drawer where he'd left it that morning, he pulled the cover off and popped it in his mouth. When it beeped, he pulled it out. He was up just a little over a degree from where he had been. Interesting. But as it was just a degree, he wasn't going to worry about it. Pulling his phone from his pocket, he texted his temp to the doc and put the thermometer away. After trading texts with Ben Beeman, he returned to the study. When he came in, Mordecai was on his phone, standing on the other side of the room, speaking intensely in Hebrew. Harvath looked over at Sloane, who nodded at her own phone sitting nearby. She was recording. Good. He liked Mordecai, but you learned quickly in their business not to trust anyone. The Israeli pulled the phone away from his ear and said to Harvath,
It's in Israel. 75 cases and counting. 9 people have bled out, and we're hearing there may be